By revealing the structure of DNA in the early 50s, Francis Crick and James Watson opened the doors to a revolution in understanding which has ultimately allowed us to manipulate fundamental aspects of life. Now at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies in La Jolla, California, Dr. Crick is addressing another of humanity's seemingly immutable questions as he focuses his current research on trying to understand the basis for human consciousness. We now join Dr. Crick for a discussion about this latest work with host Dr. Nick Spitzer.
Thank you for joining me this evening. Tonight it is my pleasure to welcome Francis Crick, the 1962 Nobel laureate in physiology and medicine, the discoverer of the structure of DNA, who is this year giving the Stephen W. Kuffler Lectures in Neuroscience. Welcome, Francis.
Glad to be here.
How did your interests initially evolve from DNA and molecular biology to neuroscience and consciousness? This is quite a leap.
Well, I think I've always been interested in it. And really, it came after the war, when I was still working for the British Admiralty, and I had to decide what to go into. And after much thought, I decided there were two regions of science I was particularly interested in, the division between the living and the non-living, which we'd now call molecular biology, and how our brains work, and it's particularly about consciousness. And after some reflection, I chose the first one, because I didn't think I could do both. And that's how I started in molecular biology. And then in 1976, when I came to the Salk and was tempted to stay, because I'd been visiting before the Salk Institute in San Diego, I decided now would be the time to make the switch. I did know people before them. I was quite friendly with David Huber, who spoke in this series last year, for example, and I was under the impression I knew something about the subject, which I soon found not to be correct. So apart from a transition period when I was still doing some things in molecular biology, for the last 20 years I've been mainly concentrated on how the brain works, and in particular primate brains, our brains, apes, and particularly monkeys on the one hand, and especially the visual system, how we see things.
Mm-hmm. What approaches have you been taking in pursuing these objectives? In particular, have you been using some of the strategies that were key to your tremendous success in developing the structure of DNA?
Well, you know, the structure of DNA was really a chapter of accidents. We made a whole series of mistakes which we gradually uncovered. So I don't know that that's the best way to go. I think possibly it was more in the subsequent period when we were doing propaganda for how genes influence the synthesis of proteins, what's called the genetic code. Mm-hmm. I think the experience that I had then, because then you had to think about different levels. I mean, the way that genetics was originally done, it was a sort of black box subject. You didn't look too much inside the organism. And, of course, we wanted to look inside. And those combination of points of view, so I think that did help.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What is the way in which you have tried to focus your efforts on the subject of specifically consciousness? This is a very large problem. One has only to think about it briefly to appreciate how difficult it is to approach this. How have you tackled it?
Well, when I first started to be interested in the visual system of primates, I didn't specifically concentrate on consciousness. I started off learning all the things that David Huber and his colleagues had done and what had been done along those lines since. And it was only after a certain number of years I began to think, well, perhaps we should begin to worry about what corresponds to what we see, as opposed to what's just going on in the back of our brains when we see. And I think the approach there was to try and not spend a lot of time on discussion on whether it might be this or that, but try to narrow it down to find things that you could do with an experiment. And you can put this in a very straightforward way. A lot of what goes on in your brain is unconscious. A lot of the processing. Some of the results of that processing you become conscious of. What's the difference between the two when you look inside the brain? I mean, when you put it that way, it's a very simple question. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it's not an easy one to answer.
Mm-hmm. 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 How is consciousness organized in the brain? Should we think of it as a localized process, or is it diffusely organized?
Well, essentially, what it looks like is if it's you can be conscious of a lot of different things. The bit of the brain which is mainly involved being consciousness of you seeing in color is not the same as the bit of the brain which is involved when you see things move, for example, mm-hmm. and so on. So it's distributed over a number of places. It's not everywhere in the brain, and it's not all the activity. Mm-hmm. If it were in just one place and we had to find the one place, that would be easy. But essentially, from brain damage, we don't think that is the case. Yeah. There are a few cases where, with brain damage, people become unconscious, but that's rather like pulling the plug out of the television set. The mm-hmm. signal goes off, but it doesn't tell you, as it were, what's actually appearing on the screen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In your work on DNA and the other important work in the area of molecular biology, you focused a lot on structure, and structure gave you key insights into function. Do you believe that in your studies of the nervous system, where again you've paid a lot of attention to structure, that this will provide important clues to understanding consciousness?
Well, we certainly hope so. Of course, you have to use both. See, when I started, I thought, well, I better learn what's called neuroanatomy. That's the anatomy of the nervous system. Because, first of all, not being a doctor, not having an MD, I didn't know any neuroanatomy. And I thought, well, it's a bit, a lot to remember. I better learn it first. But by good fortune, there were new methods introduced by neuroanatomy about that period, which made the results much more reliable. And so I became really quite interested in it, and still am. Mm-hmm. But one has to realize the neuroanatomy is only... what you can do sometimes with neuroanatomy is to prove that a theory is wrong, because it may say the theory may demand a connection between here and here, and there is maybe no such connection. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, ultimately, and you want to know what actual nerve cells are doing, not where they are and what they look like, but what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you'll need the combination of the two, namely, you want to know which neuron is doing what. Mm-hmm. And for that, you need to know which each neuron, what each neuron looks like, putting it crudely.
It sounds as though, just as the geometry of the DNA molecule gave you an important insight, perhaps also the geometry of the brain may be illuminating in understanding consciousness.
It's certainly illuminating, but remember, the system is much more complex. Mm-hmm. We had the enormous advantage of DNA, that it was a very simple structure. Because it goes back to near the origin of life, where things had to be simple. I think that's the basic reason. Mm-hmm. When you study the brain, on the other hand, it's a late product of evolution. It's likely to be inherently complex. Yes. So we are looking for simple aspects of it, but we'll be very lucky if we find anything as like DNA, which, as it were, gave the game away. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we always hope.
Keep our fingers crossed.
Yes.
It's natural to wonder whether there might be specific correlates of consciousness in terms of the electrical activity or biochemical activity of the brain. Does your work suggest that may be the case?
Well, certainly the work of our close friends and colleagues showed that some parts of the brain, under certain conditions, the behavior, the activity of the nerve cell correlates fairly closely with what you see, and not always with what's just coming into your eyes. Mm-hmm. But that's so far only a beginning, and we can think of lots of other methods of doing it. Well, one obvious thing is that when people are under an anesthetic or reasonably deep anesthetic, they're unconscious. So what's the difference in the behavior in the brain when you're alert and when you're under an anesthetic? Probably would have to be done on a monkey, but that's the sort of question that we want our people to study.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Consciousness has been referred to by some people as a kind of symphony of activity in the brain, and scientists, you particularly, many scientists, have always been enthusiastic about a very reductionist approach in which one takes apart the subject in question and analyzes each component with a view then to reconstructing the whole. Do you think that one can take a reductionist approach to consciousness? One might understand that the cello, the flute, and the piccolo, but somehow miss the essence of the music in this process.
Well, I think what one has to say, even with the reductionist approach, that you have to study any system, and the brain in particular, at different levels. So you have to study it at the level of psychology, the way we're talking now, this sort of thing, for example. Then you have to think about the levels of all the neurons interacting in systems. Then you have to think of the level of the individual neurons, which are made of molecules and so on. Then you have to get down to the actual structure of the molecules. Mm-hmm. So the important thing is to not to concentrate on one level, but to attend to all levels. And there's a general rule that if you want to prove or disprove a theory at one particular level, say at the systems level, maybe you can do that by going down one level and looking at the neurons. Mm-hmm. So in fact, I haven't paid in recent years so much attention to the molecular level, though I've been having to do so more. Mm-hmm. I've been more concerned with the large-scale organization of the brain, mm-hmm. and things like memory and attention and things of that sort, which would be thought to be at a higher level. Mm-hmm. So I am a reductionist, but I'm not a sort of I'm not the caricature of reductionist that some people
are. Mutual friends of ours, yes. How would you describe a progress in understanding consciousness? Consciousness is something that the ancient Greeks were aware of many years ago. Are there particular landmarks or milestones that you might point to that give us some sense of the progress that's being made in understanding consciousness? For example, is it realistic to expect that we'll have a reasonably clear, broad picture of how consciousness works within the next 5 or 10 years?
Well, that's, of course, anybody's guess. And I once rashly said a few years ago we might understand the outlines of it by the year 2000, and I think that's going to be I'm going to be wrong about that. Of course, we won't understand the details. The real question is whether we'll have a sufficient insight to see what sort of basic mechanism is involved, if there is a basic mechanism, or a serious one, in the time. Just the same in molecular biology. Finding the structure of DNA and genetic code was only a beginning to actually working out what was always going on, and that's so. So I would hope that somewhere in the next tens of years we will get enough insight to be able to see that. But of course it will take a much longer time to work out all the details. And remember that much of what goes on in your brain is unconscious, and that may be the more difficult part to follow rather than the conscious part.
Yes, yes, yes. Are there particular technologies that you envisage or know about currently that you think will be key in giving us these initial insights?
Well, of course, the one that people are enthusiastic at the moment are various sorts of brain scans, so you can see the activities in human brains. But that's on a rather coarse scale, although it is illuminating. And then, of course, at the other extreme is putting electrodes into the heads of people, usually into heads of animals, and following that, and putting in also multiple electrodes, so you can follow more than one neuron at the same time. But I don't think that will be adequate. And what I think will be useful is the increasing techniques coming from molecular biology, mm-hmm. coming from the Human Genome Projects and all that, giving us new tools to apply. So it's those new tools I think I look forward to, which will help to dissect the system at a very fine level. Mm-hmm. If you want to understand a complex system, you really have to interfere with it very delicately and very precisely. Mm-hmm. And that's it's difficult to see how to do that unless you use these molecular biology tools, which we hope will come along.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. From what you've said about the focus currently on the broader aspects of consciousness, maybe inappropriate to ask the following question, but I want to try you on it anyway. Your background as the consummate molecular biologist would make you an ideal person to try to describe the parameters of consciousness in molecular and biochemical terms. Do you think that there's anything that can be said about that at the present time, or is that level of understanding still fairly remote.
I can't think we can say at the present time, but of course we, and in this case I shouldn't say much of the work I do, almost all the work I do this is with a colleague at Caltech, Christoph Koch, and of course we worry about that, but and think along those lines, but at the moment we don't know how to get down to that, what you might call more molecular level. We're more worrying about neurons and systems of neurons, but we're always on the lookout to see whether there's some neurons with peculiar properties, just as DNA has peculiar properties compared with protein.
Yeah.
We're always on the lookout for that, but it could be that there isn't any special thing at that level. It is the way the things interact.
Yes, yes. You'd emphasized a moment ago that very often the solution of a complicated problem is facilitated by dropping down to a somewhat lower level of complexity. And in this connection, of course, it's natural to wonder whether or not other organisms, other than human beings and the higher primates, have consciousness. I'm sure you've thought about this at some length. How do you see that issue?
Well, people love to discuss this, and we find it isn't very fruitful. And so one of the things we say is we were not going to discuss whether fruit flies or little worms are conscious, or for that matter, more interesting animals like octopus and squid, for example, where you could have doubts. We do make the working hypothesis that the primates at least got some degree of consciousness, though of course they don't have language, so they're certainly limited in that respect. And one would, if you have to guess, one think it would be probably true of some in a mouse. Mm-hmm. But it isn't necessarily to say they have it to the same degree, but they may nevertheless have some aspects of it. Mm-hmm. If we knew more precisely what we were looking for, if we had a well-established theory, then we could perhaps go down to some of these simpler animals and explore it then. But at the moment, we have to stick to animals which are close to ourselves, because we know we are conscious, and strictly we don't know that any other animal is conscious. Mm-hmm. We have to have that as a working assumption, which eventually, of course, will have to be proved or disproved one way or the other.
Some people, eminent physicists, for example, have gone so far as to suggest that consciousness is really a collective phenomenon, and that large ensembles of objects that we might consider relatively inanimate can display functions that might be thought of as consciousness. Is this poppycock, or is this...
Well, who were you thinking of especially?
Well, I was thinking of somebody like Professor Roger Penrose with some of his theories. I think perhaps, again, your point that we haven't got a firm enough grasp of the essence of human consciousness might make that put that into the class of subjects that one really would not find profitable to discuss at any great length.
Well, I think because the phenomenon is so peculiar and difficult to explain, one shouldn't dismiss out of hand people having what you might call way-out ideas. The particular one that Roger Penrose has put forward, which is based on very complex arguments on the foundations of mathematics as to how mathematicians get ideas and so on, and then is carried through to something which, his ideas about quantum gravity, I happen not to think that that looks very promising. And we do correspond on the matter, but there are other people. So I don't think one should dismiss all theories like that automatically, but I don't think one should become over-enthusiastic about them too early.
Very good. Many people here in the States, of course, are now seeing the approach of the end of the so-called decade of the brain from the point of view of raising popular awareness and stimulating research in the field of neuroscience. This has been an exciting period. Have we learned important information during this last decade about consciousness that you would like to emphasize, perhaps, at this point?
Well, we have learned things. I suppose the most striking work is the work of Nikos Lagathetis, who's a Greek working in Tübingen in Germany. And essentially, he studies in a monkey a phenomenon where you put one signal into one eye, say something like this, and you put another signal into the other eye, such that they're overlapped like this. You might think that what you see was this, but what you actually see is first this, and then this, and then this, and then this. But what's coming into your eyes is constant. But what you're perceiving is changing. And then you look into the brain of the monkey and find which neurons are following what's coming in and which ones whose firing is correlated with what the monkey is reporting it's seeing. And that's really quite striking. And the further you go into the visual system, because it's a hierarchical system, the more neurons follow what you actually see, follow the percept. And that's only a beginning. There are lots of reasons why the experiments need to be extended and done, looked in other areas of the brain and so on. But at least that would be an example of something that which we didn't know 10 years ago.
If you were to speak, as I know you have and continue to do, to young people who are coming into the field of neuroscience, how would you encourage them to focus their efforts on various scientific problems? Consciousness and the other issues of higher cognition, are these areas now that are ripe in the sense of making productive advances for them to tackle?
Well, I think you have to ask, look at it from their point of view and ask, will you be able to get grants to study it? Because if they can't do that, they're not going to get anywhere. And the advice we give to younger people is that they should concentrate on something which shows some chance of getting in more immediate return, some part of the system. There are lots and lots of problems for that. But keeping a wide interest into the problem of consciousness so that when they have got these skills and got this background, this knowledge, then they may be in a few years' time, well, and so on, and they may be able to see that they can apply it to the problem of consciousness. But it'd be very rash to advise a young person, unless he had independent financial means, to go into consciousness at this stage. It's all right for me because I can do what I like, and you know. And in the case of Christoph Koch, he only devotes a small portion of his time to this. He works on the computation of neurons and other things and so on. So the simple advice is yes, but the time will come, of course. Well, it will be, if there is any breakthrough, then it will become a hot subject, and then the young people can go into directly. But I don't think we're at that stage yet.
If there were an opportunity to ask a potentially omniscient deity just a single question about the nature of consciousness, what kind of question do you think you might want to ask?
Well, you know, that's a very tricky one, and there's a nice quotation I have from Steven Weinberg that says that often you don't know what the right question to ask is until you're very close to the answer. And I think this is true in this case. Now, I could think of a number of ones I'd like to know. For example, it's to do with the brain as a whole, but is what is significant to the brain the average rate at which a neuron fires and sends out spikes, or does the timing of the individual spikes matter? What is the language the brain uses? We know it can use both of those things in extreme cases. And that's absolutely key question. I would love to know the answer to that one. It would very much help us in constructing our theories of consciousness if we were clear about that. Now, this is a topic which is much under debate. There are good theoretical reasons for thinking that the timing of the spikes is going to matter. You can compute much more quickly and so on, but the evidence in favor of it is still very flimsy. Otherwise, I don't know what to ask.
Well, except
just the answer. Say, what's the answer to the question?
Well, that's too blunt.
Yes, that's right.
Too direct. Too direct. One thing that is certainly remarkable to me, Francis, having as an undergraduate and a graduate student, following very important work in molecular biology and seeing your energetic pursuit of neuroscience, always fascinated me to see the extraordinary energy and enthusiasm with which you've pursued these objectives. What's your secret?
Well, as I get older, I must tell you I don't have as much energy. I may have as much enthusiasm, but that may be just the folly of age. So I have to husband my resources somewhat. In fact, in theory, I only work half-time. Not this last week. I shall be taking some time off to compensate for that. Well, otherwise, you know, I'm very happily married, for example, and I think a very important thing is to take regular it's just the usual things, you know, drink too much, don't eat too much, take some regular exercise, and try and avoid stress. That's the other thing. Try and not get involved in situations which you find particularly stressful. Mm-hmm. I mean, some people, what may be stressful for me, other people will sail through, you see. So, I don't think I have anything to offer beyond the standard medical advice to older people.
Yeah. Well, it's very impressive to all of us, and it's been really delightful to have this opportunity to meet with you and to discuss these interesting topics. Thanks very much.
Well, I've enjoyed the discussions.
Thank you.